bad beams are gonna blind me, but I won't feel blue like I always do. 'Cause somewhere in the crowd there's...
Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is February 26th, 2019, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Superglottic Airways Gonna Save You for an OOKA. And our guest skeptic is Missy Carter, former City of Bremerton firefighter paramedic, currently a physician assistant practicing in emergency medicine in the Seattle area, and an adjunct faculty member with the Tacoma Community College Paramedic Program. Welcome to the SGEM, Missy.
Thanks, Ken. It's super excited to be here.
Well, I'm excited to have you here because we first met in Las Vegas.
Yes, we did, at the boot camp.
Yeah, we were at the boot camp that was put on for PAs and NPs. There were some physicians there, but it was mainly, I don't know, what was it, 500 to 1,000 PAs and NPs in Las Vegas learning about emergency medicine?
Yeah, it was a huge group, a giant auditorium, lots of awesome energy there.
Yeah, it's a fantastic course. And if anybody's listening and interested in going to a boot camp to get their skills up to speed, this boot camp is fantastic. Now, they have an original boot camp, but they also have an advanced boot camp. Planning on going to the advanced one?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I've been looking at dates and some locations.
So hopefully what you learned in Las Vegas didn't stay in Las Vegas and you brought it home to Tacoma.
Definitely. In fact, I purchased the recorded package so I could listen to it over and over. A lot of good information packed in there.
Well, it is a lot of information all at once, and it has this fantastic faculty. And we do these 30-minute talks, so you get like really high-quality, high-impact information that you can take home and use the very next day you're on shift.
Yeah, and in fact, this was my first emergency medicine conference right after graduating. I'd only had 4 days on the job before going to the conference. So I was super excited to be able to start applying all that information right away.
Speaking of overwhelming then, we don't just have one paper today. We have two for that price of one, which is always free. And it's going to be on superglottic airways for out-of-hospital cardiac arrests.
Yeah, I do have to admit, I'm really nerdy when it comes to airway topics. I think I actually started bugging you to review the Airways 2 trial before it was even published. So you can imagine my excitement when you told me I was getting two, not one, but two trials.
And I wouldn't call it bugging. I mean, I really like it when people reach out to me and say, hey, Ken, have you seen this paper? I think you should do a critical review on it and put your skeptical eye upon it. And most of the time I go, hey, that looks like a good paper. Want to come on the show and talk nerdy to me?
Well, I was definitely fangirling out, you might say, when you said that. I was like, yes, I thought you'd never ask.
Okay, let's stop talking about fangirls and stuff and get to a case.
Sounds good. So EMS arrived to your emergency department with a 68-year-old male. He's post-cardiac arrest patient. They had a difficult time getting a definitive airway in the pre-hospital, and it required multiple attempts, which caused several prolonged interruptions in CPR. After the patient is stabilized, the medic asks you how he can improve his airway management skills. He found it really difficult to intubate the patient during cardiac compressions. What should you tell him?
Well, we've covered out-of-hospital cardiac arrest many times in the SGEM, and key to survival is high-quality CPR and early defibrillation. There is no evidence for a patient-oriented benefit with epinephrine, other ACLS drugs, pre-hospital therapeutic hypothermia, or mechanical CPR. But there's one issue we have not discussed on the SGEM, and that's endotracheal intubation.
So for many years, endotracheal intubation, it's been the standard of airway management for out-of-hospital cardiac arrests. But over the recent years, we've been questioning if this is really the best way to go about things. Endotracheal intubation is a very technical skill. It requires optimal positioning, proficiency, and a technical skill level which may be difficult to obtain in the pre-hospital cardiac arrest setting.
So what's the clinical question then, Missy?
Are supraglottic airway devices non-inferior to endotracheal intubation in out-of-hospital cardiac arrest in regards to neurologic outcomes.
And what's the reference?
Benger et al., effect of a strategy of a supraglottic airway device versus tracheal intubation during out-of-hospital cardiac arrest on functional outcomes. This is the Airways 2 trial. It's a randomized clinical trial, JAMA 2018.
All right, let's run through the PICO. What was the population?
Adults who had a non-traumatic out-of-hospital cardiac arrest.
And they had a number of exclusions, which included prison service, resuscitation deemed inappropriate, an advanced airway already in place, and the patient's mouth open less than 2 centimeters. Now, I'll translate that for you, Missy, because you're in the U.S. That's just under an inch.
Ooh, tiny mouth.
What was the intervention?
So the intervention was the insertion of a second-generation supraglottic device with a soft, non-inflatable cuff.
And what did they compare it to?
They compared it to the standard of care, endotracheal intubation with direct laryngoscopy.
All right, let's run through their outcomes. What was their primary outcome?
The primary outcome was neurologic outcome at discharge or 30 days using the modified Rankin score. They classified a good outcome as a score from 0 to 3 and a bad outcome as a score from 4 to 6.
All right, and they had a number of secondary outcomes. What were they?
So initial ventilation success.
Yeah, and they defined that as visualizing the chest rise and fall.
They looked at regurgitation.
Yeah, and stomach contents visible in the mouth or nose or aspiration.
An unintended loss of a previously established airway. Sequence of airway interventions delivered, return of spontaneous circulation, airway management in place when ROSC was achieved or when resuscitation was discontinued. They looked at chest compression fraction and time to death.
So the author's conclusions were, quote, among patients with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, randomization to a strategy of advanced airway management with a supraglottic airway device compared with tracheal intubation did not result in a favorable functional outcome at 30 days. End of quote. All right, let's run through the 11 quality checklist questions for randomized clinical trials. The first question, Missy, the study population, did it include or focus on those in the emergency department?
No, Ken, this was a pre-hospital study.
Did they adequately randomize the patients?
Yes, the study was done by a cluster randomization by paramedics randomized to either SGA or ETI.
And we're going to get a little bit deeper into that idea of cluster randomization in the nerdy section. The third question, though, is the randomization process, was it concealed?
No, of course the paramedics couldn't be blinded to SGA or intubation. The patients were unaware because they were not alive at the time.
All right, and the fourth question, the patients, were they analyzed in the groups to which they were randomized? In other words, did they do an intention to treat analysis?
Yes, the primary analysis included all eligible patients with outcome data available, except for those patients following secondary outcomes. That only applied to those who received advanced airway management. Those included any unintended loss of a previously established airway, return of spontaneous circulation during airway management, and finally, airway management in place when return of spontaneous circulation was achieved or when resuscitation was discontinued.
Did they recruit their patients consecutively?
No. Paramedics had clinical freedom to adapt the airway management based on clinical grounds. So the anatomy of the patient, the position they were in, and any perceived needs that the paramedics saw. More about that in the nerdy section.
And were the patients in both groups similar with respect to prognostic factors?
Yes, they were very similar. You can see this in Table 1.
The seventh question, all participants were unaware of group allocation.
No, clinicians could not be blinded. Patients were blinded, but were unsure if the outcomes assessors were blinded.
All groups were treated equally except for the intervention.
Yes, treatment was provided by local protocols.
Was the follow-up complete?
Yes, very complete.
Were all patient important outcomes considered?
Yes, we think so.
And the final question, the treatment effect, was it large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
We're not completely sure about this one. We'll talk some more in the nerdy section.
All right, let's run through the key results. They enrolled just over 9,000 patients with out-of-hospital cardiac arrests. The mean age was 73 years, and just over a third were women. What was the big take-home result?
The big take-home here was supraglottic airway was non-inferior to tracheal intubation.
We've got to give them some numbers, okay? So that for that primary outcome, that dichotomous outcome between good and bad, or a modified Rankin scale of 0 to 3 considered good, what was the primary outcome?
So the modified Rankin scale from 0 to 3 was 6.4% in the supraglottic group versus 6.8% in the ETI group.
And how about the secondary outcomes?
Two of the secondary outcomes, regurgitation and aspiration, were not significantly different between groups.
And there was a difference in initial ventilation, which was successful in 87% of the patients in the supraglottic group compared with 79% in the endotracheal group.
And then patients who were randomized to receive an endotracheal tube were actually less likely to receive any advanced airway management.
Missy?
Yes?
Guess what time it is?
Is it time to talk nerdy?
It is time to talk nerdy. Oh, my favorite part of every podcast, I think. I love getting into the nerdiness. All right. So guess how many points we have?
Let me think. Not seven. That'd be too many. Three would be too few. Let's go with five.
Let's go with five. Okay. And I'll take the first one because this is about cluster randomization. And cluster randomization trials, they have been around for a very long time. And rather than randomizing the individual patients, it randomized groups of patients to the intervention or control group. And there are strengths and weaknesses to any trial design, and randomized cluster designs also have strengths and weaknesses. One of the strengths is to avoid contamination between interventions when trial participants are being managed within the same setting. One weakness is cluster randomized trials have decreased returns in power and precision as cluster sizes increase. Now, in this study, they attempted to mitigate this limitation by having a large number of clusters to increase the accuracy of their results. Hopefully that wasn't too nerdy for you.
So our second nerdy point is about crossover. Paramedics have the clinical freedom to adapt from the assigned treatment group. Only 81% of the patients actually received an advanced airway. This was similar between the two groups. There was more crossover, however, from endotracheal intubation to the supraglottic group, 19% versus 3%. Mitigating the problem of crossover, they did an intention to treat analysis.
Good nerdy point. The third nerdy point, though, is about the bias against endotracheal intubation. And there did seem to be a bias against obtaining an advanced airway in paramedics who were randomized to the endotracheal group. They were less likely to perform an advanced airway. It was 14% versus 22%. And this could have biased and impacted the results.
Next, we looked at first pass success. We know from multiple prior studies that there's an association between increased intubation attempts and increased mortality. This trial showed a 69% success rate in the ET group compared to an 89% first pass success rate in the supraglottic group. Although this trial had a pretty low first pass success rate compared with previous meta-analysis, 70% versus 90%, it's much higher than the 51% that we see in the Wang trial we'll discuss next.
All right, and the fifth and final nerdy point we wanted to talk about this paper was sensitivity and subgroup analyses for the primary outcome. The patients who received advanced airway management, and remember that was about 80% of patients, were grouped by the first type of advanced airway intervention received. That is accounting for crossover and excluding the patients who did not receive an advanced airway. Supraglottic insertion as the first method showed better outcomes compared to endotracheal intubation, and it was 4% versus 2%, which was statistically significant. However, before you overinterpret that statistical significance, you've got to remember these subgroup analyses, even if they were designed pre-hoc, should be viewed only as hypothesis generating. All right, that's it for the five nerdy points. Can you comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEM's conclusions?
So this trial provides a very large data set that suggests that supraglottic devices are not inferior to endotracheal intubation.
Now I'm going to stop you there before we get into, like, you know, what's the bottom line and what are you going to, how are you going to resolve the case or tell the patient? Why don't we just review the second paper and then mash that up at the end? Is that okay?
Sounds great.
All right. What's the clinical question? What's the clinical question number two?
So does the use of the LT supraglottic device have an effect on 72-hour survival when compared to endotracheal intubation in out-of-hospital cardiac arrest?
And this reference is the Wang reference, which you talked about just at the end of the nerdy points. And this is Wang et al., effects of strategy of initial laryngeal tube insertion versus endotracheal intubation on 72-hour survival in adults with out-of-hospital cardiac arrests, a randomized clinical trial. And again, this was in JAMA 2018. Let's run through the PICO. What was their population?
Adult patients over 17 years old, suffering a non-traumatic out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, treated by EMS and requiring advanced airway management or anticipated ventilatory support.
And there were a number of exclusions. I'll list those in the show notes. What was the intervention?
The laryngeal tube insertion.
And they compared it to?
Endotracheal tube intubation.
Time for the outcomes. What was the primary outcome?
So their primary outcome was 72-hour survival rates.
And their secondary outcomes?
Return of spontaneous circulation, hospital survival, and favorable neurologic status at discharge, which they defined as a modified Rankin score of 0 to 3.
All right, the author's conclusions were, quote, among patients with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, a strategy of initial LT insertion was associated with significantly greater 72-hour survival compared with a strategy of initially ETI. These findings suggest that LT insertion may be considered as the initial airway management strategy in patients with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, but limitations of the pragmatic design, practice setting, and ETI performance characteristics suggest that further research is warranted. That was a long sentence.
A mouthful.
Yeah, let's go through the quality checklist for this study. Are these ED patients?
Nope, this too is a pre-hospital study.
Did they adequately randomize them?
Yes, there was 27 EMS agencies that were randomized into 13 crossover clusters.
Did they conceal the randomization?
Yes.
Did they do an intention to treat analysis?
Yes.
The study patients were recruited consecutively?
Unsure. They did not specifically state if it was consecutive recruitment.
And were patients in both groups similar with respect to prognostic factors?
They weren't, but we'll cover this more in the nerdy section.
Were all the participants unaware of group allocation?
No. Clinicians, of course, could not be blinded here either.
All groups were treated equally except for the intervention?
Yes. EMS personnel followed local protocols for confirmation of airway placement and management of out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, including the termination of resuscitation efforts in the field.
Was the follow-up complete?
Yes.
Did they consider all patient important outcomes?
Yes, survival and good neurologic outcome.
All right, and number 11, the treatment effect was large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant.
We're also unsure about this.
All right, let's go through the key results. They recruited and analyzed just over 3,000 patients with a median age of 64 years, with 39% women. What was their result?
We saw greater survival in the LT group compared to the ET tube group.
All right, and we'll get some numbers on that. For their primary outcome, which I'll remind everybody, was 72-hour survival rate.
We had 18% in the LT group versus 15% in the ETI group.
And for the secondary outcomes, I'll put a table in the show notes, but tell us about ROSC survival and good neuro.
So for ROSC, hospital survival and good neurologic outcomes, the LT was significantly better than ET tube.
Missy.
Yes.
You know what time it is again.
Talk Nerdy to Me, Ken.
Oh, and you know there's a song, there's a video out called Talk Nerdy to Me.
What?
Maybe I'll put a link in the show notes to that one because it's very nerdy. Anyways, I will go again first because I love talking nerdy. and I'm going to talk about first pass success. The initial LT and ETI success rate, now this is excluding bag valve masks, were 90% versus 52% respectively. So patients with LTs were much more likely to have a first pass success over endotracheal intubation. Multiple prior studies have shown increased mortality with increased intubation attempts. It's possible that the low first pass success endotracheal tube intubation rate seen in this trial could have skewed the data, and I would suggest that it would skew the data towards the LT group, the supraglottic group, because they had a 90% first pass success rate.
So the second nerdy point we want to talk about is bag valve mask. The key results on the primary outcome showed greater survival in the LT group. However, they included patients who only received BVM, so they didn't receive an LT or an ETI. In the author's results sections, they list the data with the BVM group removed. In this as-treated analysis, the 72-hour survival difference was not statistically different. So you take out the group of people who only received BVM, and you lose the statistical significance.
And it's really hard. Every time I hear you say BVM, my dyslexia jumps in, and I'm starting to hear DMV.
Terrifying.
The third nerdy point is about lack of blinding. There was no blinding to the intervention, allocation, crossover, timing, and outcome ascertainment. All of this could have biased the results.
Number four, unbalanced groups. Cluster randomization can lead to unbalanced baseline characteristics. One of the most powerful prognostic factors in survival of out-of-hospital cardiac arrest is the initial rhythm. Shockable rhythms were observed in 20% of the patients in the LT group versus only 18% in the ETI group. When they did a post-hoc analysis and adjusted for age, sex, rhythm, response time, witness status, etc., and bystander CPR, the statistical significance disappeared. It was gone.
And the fifth and final point is something that we've talked about before in the SGEM, and that's the fragility index. Looking at their primary outcome, and that's the 72-hour survival, the fragility index of this study was 3. There were also 4 patients missing from the data set. This severely limits any strong conclusions that can be drawn from this trial. All right, the nerdiness is over. Talk about the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEM's conclusions.
So we would change the conclusions to say, among adults in out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, LT insertion may or may not be considered as an initial airway management strategy.
Did you see my eyes light up when you said that? May not. Love it. Okay, now we can do an SGEM bottom line.
So adults with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, key factors for survival with good neurologic outcome are early defibrillation and high-quality CPR. Airway strategies don't seem to be as important.
And can you resolve the case you presented?
The case resolution is the patient goes on to have a poor neurologic outcome, like most of our patients with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest.
Yeah, and if you look back to the OPALS trial with Ian Steele, out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, survivors were about 5%, and yet the public gets a really distorted view of who survives cardiac arrest. And if you look at television, and I know these are in-hospital cardiac arrest, but if you look at television series and you look at Grey's Anatomy and ER or Chicago Hope or one of these medical dramas, their survival rate is up like 70, 80%. And yet in real life, in-hospital cardiac arrest is only about 12%. So I wanted to put a little reality into the case resolution. How are you going to apply this clinically, though?
So using a supraglottic airway device is a reasonable management option for patients without a hospital cardiac arrest. This could cognitively unload paramedics and allow them to concentrate on those things that have been demonstrated to improve patient-oriented outcomes, like early defibrillation and high-quality CPR.
So what are you going to tell that medic that asked you a question?
So you tell the medic that we don't really have good evidence on what's the best airway management strategy in these cases. Inserting a supraglottic airway is easier, faster, and more successful. However, it does not appear to result in a better outcome for the patients. The bottom line is, don't get distracted by airway management, but focus on what we know actually saves patients: early defibrillation and high-quality CPR.
Time to announce the Keener contest winner, and last week's winner was Matt Kennedy. He knew that normal saline contains 9 grams per liter of sodium chloride, which is equal to 154 milliequivalents of both sodium and chloride. What's the question this week?
So when was the first phototypical laryngeal mask used on a live person?
And I'm going to give people a hint, Missy. It was in the 1980s. Yes.
Yes.
Oh, like most good things, 1980s. Okay. There is some other FOMED out on this from our good friend at Rebel EM, Salim Razai, and I'll include those in the show notes. Missy, thank you very much for reaching out to me, trying to prompt me to cover the Airway 2 trial, and then staying after me and saying, Ken, we've got to cover this one.
It's really been my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, now you get to read the SGEM tagline. And one of the things I really like to do, because this is an audio podcast, of course, is that I want people to give me their best tagline in their thickest accent. Now, you're from Washington, so that makes you a Washingtonian or something like that. Can you give the tagline in your best Washingtonian accent?
Well, Ken, I'm sorry, but Washingtonians, we speak perfectly and we do not have an accent. I would love to, however, do my best Canadian accent.
Oh, you go ahead, eh?
Remember, be skeptical of anything you learn, eh? Even if you heard it on The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine, you hoser.
Oh, you even got the hoser in there. Talk to everyone next week.